Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She is USU's extension entomologist, and we're going to start out the program talking about insects. So if you have any questions or comments, you can reach us by calling 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Diane, thanks for coming in.
It's always fun, Brian.
So I've noticed in my own garden, I've got a peach tree that's not looking very, very well. And another one that's, as people have been telling you, it's bleeding,
yeah,
or it's got the gummosis
tree,
to
right.
it. So I'm like, oh, what's causing that? Because usually that's a response
to something that's going on, something bad, unfortunately. Yeah, we've had a lot of calls, a lot of inquiries this spring about, in particular, peach trees that are sapping, or the technical term for that is called gummosis, where the sap bleeds out of the bark, through the bark of the tree. And it's not, there's not just one thing that causes gummosis. As you just mentioned, it's a response to something that's going on. My feeling from talking to people this spring in particular is that probably the majority of the problem that we're seeing now, expressed now, but it happened this winter. And it was, we didn't have too many cold spells, but we did have one in particular that happened, I think it was about December 5th. It was early December. And we had that followed a fairly mild fall, November. And so it was a very rapid drop in temperature. And so peach trees that are not as winter hardy, so there's even within peach trees, there's different varieties that are, developed or appropriate to different regions of the country or different climate zones. And so even within peach varieties, there's some that are hardier than others. And so those that are less hardy, it looks like they got some winter damage from that very cold temperature drop in early December when the trees weren't hardened off as well as they could have been.
So it's responding to an injury. Is that gum supposed to help at all, or is it just...
It is. So it's a okay. response by the tree, basically kind of like, send aid to the spot where there's a problem. So in this case, where there was sap still flowing in those trees when that temperature dropped to very cold levels, it caused rupture of cells, damage, of the cambial tissue, which is where the xylem and phloem is located, but then also cracks up into the bark of the tree. And so that's basically just like when we get a wound or an injury, we have a break in our blood vessel and we have a bleeding response. So it's the same kind of thing, but when it's really cold, you're not going to get that sap production in the winter. So what happens in the spring when the tree, sap starts to flow, the tree starts to grow, where you have that injury, the sap particularly flows there in a response to try to block it up and to stop or to seal off the injury. But of course, a lot of sap's going to be coming out.
So the same thing that a conifer would do to try mm-hmm. to get the beetles that are attacking it from getting into
right.
the tree.
So push it out. And so but then once you have an injury in a tree like that, there's a number of factors that can go on. You can get different kinds of pathogenic diseases entering. So there's some fungi, one that's called like Cytospora canker or perennial canker is one that's common in our fruit trees here. There's some bacterial diseases, a Pseudomonas, like a blight type of injury that can also take advantage of those openings. And yet another factor that can be a play is that there's insect borers that will attack trees, and generally they pick, as we've talked on the show before, trees that are already under stress. And so an injured tree is going to be more under stress. Also, that sap leaking out has odors in it, chemicals that the insects can pick up on and purposely, select trees that are already succumbing to other problems and decline. But unfortunately, the temperature kind of situation that I just described that I'm suspecting was a major cause for many of the problems we're seeing in peach trees now, there's not a lot you can do about it except select varieties that are more cold tolerant and a little better suited to our climate when we get these kind of more excessive or extreme events like that.
Which is I think, kind of hard to do because usually you want to select a peach because of its flavor.
Right.
But if you can't get the flavor, and I remember, and to me it was this way, but I had a Reliance peach, and it's supposed to be more cold hardy, but I didn't like the flavor
the
very
flavor
much.
The flavor is not as tasty.
Yeah.
You're right. I have one at my house that's called Veteran. It was recommended to me by a nursery in Washington State, and I've been pretty happy with it. It doesn't get as large. It's not quite as sweet as some of the less hardy varieties, but it's a semi-freestone. But it has a really nice flavor, and so I've been happy with that one. I think it's a little better than Reliance in flavor. And there's some others out there, but you do have to look. And unfortunately, you go to your local big box store, and all these trees are sitting out there, either bare root in the spring or later in the year if they're in containers, and they have a beautiful picture of a lovely peach or whatever on it, and you pick it based on the picture or that you heard that this variety tasted really good or something, and you may not be fully aware of how cold hardy that particular variety is. And so I understand that it's easy to be kind of lulled into selecting varieties that are not the best for our location. So I fall to that. Fault myself too, not so much with peaches, but other things that I picked that I later said, like, why did I pick that?
Is there somewhere that you can go to look? Does USU Extension have a list?
We have some resources. I don't know if we have a really succinct list of the peach varieties, say, for example, or sweet cherry varieties, apple varieties, etc., that are best for our area. We do have a compilation of all our horticulture related materials and information materials on our USU Extension website. So you can go to either fruit.usu.edu or you can go through vegetable.usu.edu, and then from there you can, and there's also one about tunnels. So if you're interested in doing season extension with tunnels, it's tunnel.usu.edu, and those sites are all linked together, and then you can pick where you want to go, fruit, veggies, tunnel information. I don't know if we have a specific listing for peach varieties, but certainly Dr. Brent Black, who's our tree fruit specialist in the state, can help us out with that, and some of the extension agents around the state may have lists or recommended lists that they share with home gardeners and producers in their area.
Are there varieties of stone fruits that tend to be more resistant to insects?
In general, peach, besides this problem with the winter injury problem, they're actually a pretty good fruit tree to grow in the home garden. They do have some problems. They've got the crown borer. And places where it's a little bit warmer, they have more problems with the peach twig borer. But those can both be managed okay. Apples are very hardy and well-adapted, and pears, too. But they get codling moth, the main, the worm that gets in the fruit. So that's a downside. So out of all of those, what is the best? Whether maybe plum might be one that, has fewer insect problems than some of the others. Apricot to some extent, but it gets Carinium blight, the little pimply, it's a fungus disease on the fruit. I mean, you can still eat them fine. They just may not look as nice.
Well, and Mother Nature has found a way to, kind of balance things out. You can have this fruit, but there's always seems like there's going to be something that can attack it.
There is for everything. So, and generally having a variety of things, I think, is a good way to go. That way, if it's a particular year where maybe it's a light apple crop, because you had a heavy apple crop the previous year, they tend to be that alternate bearing. But if instead you've got a great peach crop that year or a good cherry crop that year, it kind of balances out. I did want to mention that we do have the series of fact sheets on backyard fruit pest problems, and so each fact sheet discusses the top 7, 8, 9 pests. And this includes insects and diseases and nutritional issues like iron chlorosis. We've talked a lot about that on our show before, and it's really nice and succinct. Gives you some good photos and a nice brief description of what the problem is. So that's on our Utah Pests webpage, and so. That's a good place to go if you've got a peach or cherry that's not looking too good and you want to get some idea about what the problems might be.
Well, and these fact sheets they have wonderful pictures, so you can look at them and see, okay, what does crown rot and root rot really look like? What does fire blight look like? Spider mites, coddling moth, you know, Paracilla, kind of on and on. And I'll have these links at the Zesty Garden site as well. So if you want to come as a listener and listen to the program again, or just look at some of the references, that will be available on today's program. Right now, what is the insect in question? What's moving? What's attacking the tree? Should we just start with peaches?
Well, in general, across fruit trees, we're having some of our commercial growers have been sending in questions and pictures, and we've had some at our research farm in Kaysville, just about some general different caterpillars that are out now that cause defoliation. And so this is across all of the different tree fruit crops. There's a series of them. There's one called the speckled green fruit worm. There's one called, there's different kinds of leaf rollers. And there's also, I had a picture sent a couple days ago, that's the spring cankerworm, which those that live, especially like in the Salt Lake, Ogden Valley areas where there's a lot of the scrub gamble oak along the foothills. This is the, there's two species of cankerworm. They're like little inchworm caterpillars that commonly defoliate those oaks. And so, but they'll also feed on fruit trees. So there seems to be a little rush, if you want to call that, or a little flush of caterpillar defoliators this spring so far. That's one thing that we're seeing in tree fruits.
And do tree fruits recover as quickly as I know I've seen the worms in box elder trees, mm-hmm. and I've seen one completely defoliated, and then they come out with more leaves. I don't know if I've seen that with fruit trees.
Yeah, that's, I agree. Box elder is a pretty tough, you know, it's a native tree. It's pretty hardy, but the box elder leaf roller, every so many years, it seems like we get a big flush of those, and there can be a lot of defoliated box elder trees. And as you mentioned, a lot of times they can just regrow a whole new set of leaves pretty much. And later in the summer, you would never know that it had been defoliated. No, that does not happen with fruit trees. In general, they don't have the energy reserves to be able to do that. In fact, the buds that are, you know, opening and growing this year, where there's flowers and, you know, that will form into fruit and leaves, those were all formed last summer while the tree was growing and, you know, out there photosynthesizing, making lots of energy, and it puts a certain amount into its fruit crop for that year. But it always, you know, diverts a certain amount of it into production for the next year. That's what trees do. And fruit trees just aren't, because they put so much energy into fruit, they don't have enough of that, you know, to have more than one, you know, one set of buds that could come on. So pretty much what you see growing now is what's there for this year.
And I know it's a kind of a Brent Black question too, but I had not thought of that until you were just mentioning how when you've got something like a maple tree and they produce those little caterpillar seeds, mm-hmm. versus a fruit tree that's trying to get
make a
that
big fruit,
apple on
right?
there.
There's a lot of resources that go, a lot of sugars that go into making that apple or that peach. And so it's, you know, humans have selected, you know, we originally found wild, you know, the original wild ancestors of these different kinds of fruit crops. And if you ever look at wild fruits like choke cherries and hawthorns and things like that, they're dinky little fruits. Well, that's what, you know, the wild apple and peach relatives are like too. And over time, humans select, you know, manipulated and, you know, bred varieties, types that are going to make bigger and bigger and colorful fruits and things that we want. And so we have definitely moved those kinds of trees away from being able to survive, say, severe defoliations or, you know, severe freezes where they lose a lot of buds. Yeah, the trees we have today that we cultivate, they cannot tolerate that.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in studio today. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. One of the things that you had sent to me before the program started was that coddling moth is now on the fly.
Yep.
Fortunately, it's not going to show up in Cache Valley and for another 3 weeks or so, but it's in other areas of the state, and that's a concern. And that first generation is always the one that you need to get for sure.
That's the most important one. So codling moth, just to, for those who aren't don't know, some of this might be a repetition, but this is the insect that causes the worms in the apples and pears. And so it is a moth in the adult stage, and then it lays its eggs on the fruit or leaves near fruit. And then out of those hatch a little tiny caterpillar that immediately within 24 hours, it tunnels into the fruit if it's going to live. And so it's a very short window of time of when that egg and then that little caterpillar is exposed and available to control it, so to speak. Once it's inside the fruit, there's biological control can't reach it, pesticides can't reach it, you know. It's just basically you've got a worm and a fruit in that, and that's the way it is. And so what we do to help with making the most efficient use of our insecticide sprays, because we don't want to have to use any more than we have to, is we provide this service via our IPM advisories, where we tell you when the time is for the different parts of the state to put on that first cover spray, first insecticide spray for codling moth. And so the only place in the state so far that time has already passed is in the Dixie area, our warmest part of the state. So that just as a kind of a mention, the upcoming other areas that we're looking at when this time will be is in Moab as our next area that's kind of our warmest spot, and that's just in a few days, May 11th. And then the Provo-Orem area, like we're looking at the 19th of May, Davis Salt Lake areas, 22nd of May, Pleasant View, 24th, Price, 28th, Perry, Brigham City, 30th of May, and then Cache Valley, about the 2nd of June. And these will change with temperature, because it's all temperature based. How warm it is will dictate how quickly the insect develops. And so we'll send out in our advisories an update to this as we get closer to these. So those dates will adjust a little, but at least it gives you a target where you can anticipate when the time will be.
And as far as the control methods for codling moth, can you put up pheromone traps, or do those not? Or do you have to have enough of an orchard for that to be of any use?
Right. So there, and it can be pretty confusing, because you can look in catalogs or read online blogs or whatever, and you get kind of a myriad of information, and it can be pretty confusing to the person that doesn't know. We use what are called pheromone traps to actually monitor the moths. So we know when the first adults emerge, and then we use temperature to predict when those adults will have mated, have laid eggs, and when those eggs will hatch. And that's those dates that I just shared. So we do use traps for monitoring. But the traps are not a control tool. They have a pheromone in them that attracts just the male moth. So it's a mimic of what the female moth gives off in nature. And we fool the male thinking he's coming to a female, and then voila, he's stuck in our trap. So that's a monitoring tool. There is another kind of tool that commercial growers, so if you've got 5-10 acres of contiguous apples and pears or more, you can use that same pheromone lure, but you put it out in these little dispensers, either individual hand-applied ones, or you can spray it on as a cover spray, or you can put it out in these puffer type of dispensers. And what that does is inundate the orchard with the pheromone, and the males then are unable to locate females, so you don't get mating and you don't get eggs and you don't get wormy apples. But that does not work on a small scale, smaller than the smallest we've seen success with it is about 5 acres. It seems to be about the limit.
Okay, so my half acre's not going to...
It's just not going to make it. So unfortunately, I mean, that's a great tool. We have a lot of adoption of that practice with our commercial orchards in the state. And so I think people would be surprised, the public would be surprised at how much growers have been able to reduce their pesticide use by using these kinds of tools. So beyond that, the other main control tool is insecticides. And there's a whole range of different kinds of materials you can use. You can use those that are organic. You can use those that are not organic. And so for the home gardener, there's less selection than there is for the commercial grower. But the main types of insecticides the home gardener would be using there's two main insecticides that we tend to recommend, because they give some longevity, so you're not having to have spray as often, and they're very safe to use, and they're safe on the beneficials. And so one of them is called acetamiprid, and it's sold in a number of different kinds of brands, you know, Ortho and Green Light and you know, different kinds of products like that. And then the other one is spinosad. We've talked a lot about that on the show, and that's a bacterial-based insecticide. So it's a toxin that a natural soil bacterium actually produces, and that's put into a product. And you can either get an organic version or an inorganic, which just means that it's not formulated with things that meet the organic standards. The product itself is a natural product. And those are probably the two most that we recommend. Another one that a lot of gardeners have used is Carbaryl, which is sold as the brand name Seven and other things too. And so that one is a little harsher on the beneficial insects and mites.
And isn't is it Carbaryl that's being restricted a little bit more? It seems like the EPA each year keeps
they do
making it more hard as they find out more information, at least for the homeowner to be able to purchase these
there's
things.
Over time, if you compare today with, you know, 15, 20 years ago,
remember,
there's
diazinon
there's
was
a
one
lot
that got used all the time.
Fewer homeowner products than there used to be. And the ones that are generally are safer kinds of materials, ones that are safe for people, certainly, and your pets and, you know, so forth, but also kind of lower toxicity, so they're not as harsh on natural enemies in general for the public. Yeah,
I'm always a little cautious with chemicals because I'm like, okay, well, they said it was fine once and now all of a sudden they're saying
not.
It's not. So
what's
how
changed?
Do they know what's fine now? And then 5-10 years later, they're going to say, oh, well, we were wrong. You shouldn't
That's
have
a whole
that.
A very complex issue that might take a whole hour for us to talk about. So I don't know if I want to go into much depth there about how things have changed and how pesticides are evaluated. They certainly have changed and they're more restrictive now than they used to be. There are some other options, and we on our Utah Pest webpage, we have the Utah Home Orchard Pest Management Guide, and that will give you, you know, a bigger selection of options. Also, if you sign up for the IPM advisories, those come and tell you about, you know, to write to your email address and tell you about which products. So there are other options out there. There's even things like the coddling moth granulosis virus, which is an organic product. It's a natural occurring virus that is very specific just for coddling moth. And you can buy it from some of these online organic providers like Gardens Alive or Pleasant Valley, places like that. And it tends to be more expensive and it only lasts on the tree for about 7 days. So it's shorter, you know, residual. But if that's, you know, there are options out there for different kinds of gardeners.
Well, but one of the things I've noticed, especially with using this advisory, is that the coddling moth infestation, depending on when it starts in your area, only lasts a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can just, you don't have to spray all summer long.
Nope.
You just spray during
those key times.
Those key times. And so when I use something like spinosad, and I was telling a church women's group on Tuesday evening that, and they were all excited, like, oh, really? We don't have to spray chemicals? I said, no, there are things that are available, but you have to know when to spray. You can't mm-hmm. just spray it on the tree. Otherwise,
willy-nilly.
You're wasting your money if you don't
exactly.
do it at the right times.
Exactly. So there are there's two main generations of coddling moth in the northern part of the state. In a warmer year, we'll get a partial third generation. So what we've been talking about right now is this first generation coming out and the moths, you know, laying eggs and then protecting the fruit before those eggs can hatch. And so that's the key, you know, first spray, most critical one, because if you can really kind of nip the population in the bud, so to speak, you're going to have much less for the rest of the year, assuming that you don't have a neighbor right next door where their moths all just fly into your trees. That is a caveat there you have to bring up. But then there'll be another generation a little bit later in the summer, and it's the same thing. If you can target right when the beginning of that generation, get good control, then, you know, you might be able to get away with just a couple sprays for the whole summer.
And, you know, if I have just an apple here and there that's got a worm in it.
Right. It probably
I'm
won't
okay
be 100%, but for the home gardener to have, you know, 80% of your fruit clean, that's usually a very acceptable level.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. We're going to take a quick break here. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and we'll have a few more minutes. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden. And we have a garden calendar. I wanted to give a few items. First, coming up on Thursday, May 15th, the Stokes Nature Center will host Backyard Harvest Rain Barrel Workshop. And it's from 6:30 to 8:30 on the 15th at the Willow Park Zoo Education Classroom. This workshop will provide both the barrel and great insight from environmental pros on making best use of rainwater in your homes and gardens. Registration is required and information is at logannature.org. The Tahnaquit Nature Center in St. George will feature the workshop All About Herbs Saturday, May 17th from 10 to 11 a.m. You will learn everything you want to know about herbs and more, including selecting, growing, culinary use, and preserving. The workshop is free and open to the public, and it's at 1851 South Dixie Drive. The Cache Valley Gardeners Market begins this weekend and runs through October the 18th. The market is held Saturdays from 9 to 1 at Horseshoe Willow Park at 500 West, 700 South in Logan. For a complete schedule of events at the market, visit their website at gardenersmarket.org. And then next Wednesday, May 14th, there's the Lunch and Learn series at the Logan Library in the Lake Bonneville Room. And their next workshop is on native plants to perk up park strips with Michael Pete, president of the Cache chapter of the Utah Native Plant Society. And basically, you just bring your lunch, and it's an hour long at noon, and this will be on May the 14th. So in the few minutes that we've got left, I know this isn't an insect problem, but I did want
to
mention fire blight.
I consented to talk about it, yes.
Yes. So fire blight. My apples are in full blossom, and it's raining.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's warm enough, but...
We're having a spring so far that we've had a number of high-risk events for fire blight, so I'm sure we're going to be seeing this around this year. So fire blight is a bacterial disease caused by a bacterium that invades the flowers of pome fruits. So we're talking about your apples and your pears. So not the stone fruits, but just the pome fruits. And when the flower is open, it's susceptible to this bacteria getting in. And if it lands on the part of the flower where it can grow a little infection tube down and then infect that twig or that limb. And it can kill that twig. It will kill the clusters of leaves and fruit and flowers that are there. And if severe enough, or if the tree is susceptible enough, it can actually grow down through the limb and get into the main trunk and even kill the tree. And I've had that happen to a pear of mine before.
I lost an apple tree within weeks. It just went through the
whole
tree.
It can go very fast. Not all varieties are that susceptible, but some are. So the main, and when we have warm, wet weather, as you mentioned, that when the trees are in bloom. And so the main management tool we have is antibiotics. And for the home gardener, it's primarily we're talking about streptomycin, and if they can find it, oxytetracycline. There's two different antibiotics. And we like to recommend rotating or mixing those because there is resistance in the bacterial population out there, just like there is with human bacterial pathogens.
Well, we're going to quickly go to a couple of callers, and we may not get to the second one, but Diane will answer your question off the air, so hold on. So first, we're going to go to Kurt in North Logan. Hi, Kurt. How can we help?
Hello. Hey, I have a Red Haven peach planted in the corner of my garden. It's been there 6 or 7 years. Last year was the first year we got 4 peaches on it because it always gets frozen. Last week, it was in full bloom, and when the temperatures dipped, I covered it with some drop cloths in an effort to avoid the frost damage. At what point are we past the point of frost damage if the blossom has now closed?
So while the fruit is still like a pinky fingernail size, it still has some susceptibility to temperatures that are getting down into like mid-20s and below, which hopefully we won't have any more of those. But just at, you know, freezing right around 32, you know, plus or minus a couple degrees, you should be fine at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much. And then we're going to go to Green River. We have Stu. Hi, Stu. How can we help?
Hello. Hey, I missed the very first few minutes of the program. I hope I'm not repeating anything, but I'll tell you and Diane, last year I tried to put bags on the apples, the bags that are made in Japan. They got red liner, gray outer thing. I must have did something wrong. The wind blew and I lost everything, the bags and the fruit.
Oh, that's too bad. Green River is kind of a tough spot because you get a lot of wind. And so bagging the fruit works better in a place that has less than more wind. Were these the soft kind of bags, you know, more like a fabric, or were they the paper type?
They were paper, but they have a red liner inside.
Okay. Yeah, I know. So here's another suggestion. I've had some gardeners, master gardeners, tell me they like, you know, like pantyhose, but just the little footsie things. What are they? Have a name. I can't remember what they're called. And you can buy them like in bulk, and they're just like nylons. And then those just kind of form fit over the fruit, and then you don't have that issue with them blowing away. And they're very cheap.
Okay, will that still take a twist tie?
You'll still need to, you know, slip it over the fruit and secure it with some, you know, a twist tie or something, but you won't have it flapping in the wind and being susceptible to blowing off.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll try that.
Give that a try.
Great. Thanks for your call, Stu.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, we've reached the end of our time already.
Wow, I'm glad we got those two calls.
So, yeah, that's great. Thank you for listening to The Zesty Garden. Up next is our new segment where we talk about houseplants. It's with Shane Taylor from Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and today I'm talking with Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And each month we're looking at a new plant for you to consider and to have in your home, maybe one you haven't thought about before, or maybe an old standard. And today we're going to look at an aloe. So why don't you talk about the family of aloes?
Well, Brian, aloe is a huge family, and a lot of us are very familiar with aloe vera as being that plant that you go to when you get a sunburn or any kind of cut or something that you want to protect with something natural. Aloe is a huge family, though. They come in shrub form. They come in tree form. Aloe vera itself is actually probably one of the least attractive of the aloe houseplants. Of course, one of the more functional. But they have been cultivated for so long, they don't even know where aloe vera came from. They just know somewhere in Africa. But because it was found to have curative properties not only century but millennia ago, they've been traded across the world for a long, long time. Aloe makes a great houseplant simply for the fact that it doesn't require a whole lot of direct sun. Generally, many of the aloe species come from coastal regions of South Africa where you get a lot of fog and you get a lot of protection from that direct sun. So a good bright location in your home is a good place to situate an aloe. And because they're from dry regions, it's very comparable to the air, our dry air here in Utah, and just our general climate. So they're very easy to take care of, and they're very functional. If you have an aloe vera at home and you get a sunburn, you know you know exactly where it's coming from when you just go bust a leaf off of yours and are able to rub some of that goopy stuff across the burn. Or
does that work for any aloe, or mostly just the aloe vera?
Many aloes have that same kind of goopy gel in their leaves, but aloe vera and aloe barbadensis, which is practically the same plant, those are the two to go to because they're going to have the biggest concentration in the leaf. There are decorative aloes that will also have some of that in the leaf, but they're grown more for their appearance. Like we have in the studio today, aloe brevifolia, which means a shortleaf aloe, and they're a cute little miniature version of an aloe vera or an aloe barbadensis.
And how compact does this remain? So in other words, if you wanted to put this in an area that doesn't have a lot of room for it to grow, is it going to stay pretty small? This looks like it's maybe about 4 to 5 inches across the most.
Yeah, the aloe brevifolia is going to be fully grown at about six or eight inches. That's the biggest the plant is ever going to get. And then what happens after that is instead of that plant continuing to grow larger, it will send off babies. And so you'll end up with a little patch of aloe over time. So you can take those babies out and you can transplant them into their own pots and give them to friends, or you can let it grow as a group. And aloe vera is actually best to be allowed to grow as a group because they rely on each other for support. A lot of the times when people have one aloe vera, it gets top heavy and it tips over in the pot and it's just not generally attractive. Whereas if you let those babies get bigger and it becomes a little patch of aloes, they'll hold each other up and they'll look a lot more attractive over time.
I've heard them called pups.
Pups, yeah.
Before.
Yeah, pups, kikis, all sorts of names for the little babies that the offsets that the plants will produce.
Okay, so I've got one in my living room, and right now it's sitting underneath the piano because there's not, my real living room is not that big. It was given to me by a very dear friend who has since passed away, and it's in a pot, a clay pot that is about, I don't know, a foot 14 inches across. And this aloe vera is – I don't know if it's an aloe vera, but it's an aloe, but it's humongous. It's probably 18 to 20 inches across and has these long leaves. And after I brought it in the house, let's say within 6 months, it bloomed. I've never seen an aloe that's bloomed before. So I don't know if that means it was on its last leg because it was sending out, you know, trying to create seed, or if that was a good thing.
That's actually a good thing. Aloe, they're not like the agaves or the century plants that bloom and die. Aloe will bloom under good conditions. So if it's in a spot that it likes, you'll tend to get flowers sometimes on an annual basis. And they're usually bright orange, bright pink, or white, and little tube-like flowers that pop up. Just great, great plants. Just amazing, good, easy-to-grow houseplants.
Now, this small one that you've got, you say this remains as a miniature.
Yes.
So this sounds like it would be a really good plant to give to kids.
It would be a good plant to start with because it is going to forgive them a bit. It will allow themselves to be dried out fairly well. The only thing that would harm it is if they're watering it a little too often. You know, kids can get a little overexcited about taking care of stuff, and a daily watering is going to rot these things out pretty fast. Mm. But if it, you know, if they understand that it's one of those things that they only have to water once every couple weeks. Yeah, it's a great plant that they'll have for a very long time.
So just a couple of weeks, let it dry out?
Let it go completely dry. Yeah, you want the soil to be pretty much almost to the point of being parched between waterings.
So with this big one that I've got, I tend to water it until I see water coming out the bottom and then let it go.
That's a really great way to water any plant because, of course, most of the important roots of the plant are going to be in the bottom of the pot. They go straight to the bottom. So water it thoroughly until it comes out the bottom. And then, yeah, allow that soil to feel dry to the touch before you water it again.
Is there any one type of aloe that you recommend above others to start out with?
Oh, they're all going to be pretty easy. I would say the aloe vera is going to be the good one if you want something that's medicinally useful in your home. The aloe brevifolia is the ideal one if you want an aloe that's a little bit more decorative and a little bit more compact. So those two varieties would be the ones to pick.
Okay. Shane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
We've been talking with Shane Taylor. He's the horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And we'll have him back on again next month to talk about a recommended houseplant. And today was aloe. This is Brian again. One of the things that we're looking at is a title for that particular segment. So if you have any suggestions on what to call an indoor houseplant segment, then send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. Coming up next is a second part of Petals and Prose from Helen Cannon about tulips.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and once again I hope to tell you some interesting things about the tulip. As I said last time, the tulip really originated as a native plant in Turkey. And if you think about Turkish gardens and the environment like those of the Mughals, the gardens were intimate. By laying a rug in the wilderness, the first gardens were created by nomadic Turks. Later, when they cultivated flowers, it naturally followed. In such a waterless land, trees should be planted to shade the flowers. walls were then needed to protect the trees, and more walls to protect the harem. Within these sanctuaries, water was also used for its assuaging sound as it sprang from small fountains, or for its gentle motion continually falling from scalloped basin to basin. Beds of scented flowers and roses, twining climbers, carvings, and scrolls all created that same floral privacy as in the Mughal gardens. And there was one distinctive feature of the Ottoman garden, the kiosk, a small roofed pavilion, often decorated with mother of pearl and gilding, and hung with paintings of fruits and flowers. Descriptions of these kiosks from travelers in other centuries sound too delectable, with their places for reclining and their splashing water from interior marble fountains. Contemplation and inactivity could last for hours. Imagine, there is no doubt that just to read about or to look at pictures of them is to be aware of the immediate and enviable charm that is intrinsically their own. One legacy from 16th century Turkey for which we must ever be thankful is the tulip. In Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire, he talks about three plants that he thinks have changed the world. The first is the apple, as you think about Johnny Appleseed, for example. The second he writes about is the tulip, and the third is marijuana. But in his discussion of the tulip, he talks about it as an almost archetypal image in our mind. If you say tulip, we visualize it. And I sort of demonstrated this for myself yesterday. I was asked to give a program for a women's literary group, and I decided to take paper and crayons and ask them to draw a tulip. And of course, what they came up with different variations, was the image of the tulip with its little pointed petals. But I wonder what the sort of flower that children draw if they're not drawing daisies. But what did children draw before the tulip? The word tulip is a corruption of the Turkish word for turban. The fact that the tulip's first official trip west took it from one court to another, that it was a flower favored by royalty, may also have contributed to its quick ascendancy, for court fashions have always been especially catching. The tulips is not a case where the plant had to travel the world before its virtues could be recognized at home. By the time of the emperor's consignment, the tulip had already had its own cult of admirers in the East, who had taken the flower a considerable distance from its form in the wild. In other words, when it's growing in the wild in Turkey, it typically appears as a short, pretty, cheerful flower, frank, open-faced, six-petaled star, often with a dramatic splotch of contrasting color at the base. Species tulips in Turkey typically come in red, less commonly in white or yellow. The Ottoman Turks had discovered that these wild tulips were great changelings, freely hybridizing, though it takes 7 years before a tulip grown from seed flowers and shows its new colors. But also, it's subject to mutations that produce spontaneous and wonderful changes in form and color. The tulip's mutability was taken as a sign that nature cherished this flower above all others. In his 1597 herbal, John Girard says of the tulip that, quote, "Nature seems to play more with this flower than with any other that I do know." The tulip's genetic variability has, in fact, given nature, or more precisely, natural selection, a great deal to play with. From among the chance mutations thrown out by a flower, nature preserves the rare ones that confer some advantage, brighter color, more perfect symmetry, whatever. For millions of years, such features were selected, in effect, by the tulip's pollinators, that is, insects, until the Turks came along and began to cast their own votes. The Turks did not learn to make deliberate crosses till the 1600s. The novel tulips they prized were simply said to have occurred. Darwin called such a process artificial as opposed to natural selection. But from the flower's point of view, this is a distinction without a difference. Individual plants in which a trait desired either by bees or Turks occurred wound up with more offspring. Though we self-importantly regard domestication as something people have done to plants, it is at the same time a strategy by which plants have exploited us and our desires, even our most idiosyncratic notions of beauty, to advance their own interests. In the environment of the Ottoman Empire, the best way for a tulip to get ahead was to have absurdly long petals drawn to a point fine as a needle. In drawings, paintings, and ceramics, these elongated blossoms look as though they'd been stretched to the limit by a glass blower. Those words scarcely convey the actuality and strangeness of these tulips prized by the Turks. And so I suggest that you go to the UPR website, and Brian Earle will make a picture from Anna Pavard's book of these elongated tulips. You wouldn't believe it unless you look up the pictures. When the tulip first arrived in Europe, people set about fashioning some utilitarian purpose for it. The Germans boiled and sugared the bulbs and unconvincingly declared them a delicacy. The English tried serving them up with oil and vinegar. Pharmacists proposed the tulip as a remedy for flatulence. None of these caught on, however. It finally became simply the tulip's beauty that made a good match for the Dutch temperament. Generally bereft of scent, the tulip is the coolest of floral characters. In fact, the Dutch counted the tulip's lack of scent as a virtue, a proof of the flower's chasteness and moderation. Petals curving inward to hide its sexual organs, the tulip is an introvert among flowers. It is also somewhat aloof, one bloom per stem, one stem per plant. The tulip allows us to admire it. One crucial element of beauty of the tulip that intoxicated the Dutch, the Turks, the French, and the English has been lost to us. To them, the tulip was a magic flower because it was prone to spontaneous and brilliant eruptions of color. In the planting of 100 tulips, one of them might be so possessed, opening to reveal the white or yellow of its petals, painted as if by the finest brush and steadiest hand, with intricate feathers or flames, vividly contrasting hues. As I said last time, the tulip was said to have broken. And if a tulip broke in a particularly striking manner, if the flames of the applied color reached clear to the petal's lip and its pigment brilliant and pure and its pattern symmetrical, the owner of the bulb had won the lottery, so he thought. Anna Pavard, in her book, The Tulip, recounts the extraordinary lengths to which Dutch growers would go to make their tulips break, sometimes borrowing their techniques from alchemists who faced what must have been a comparable challenge. Over the earth, above a bed planted with white tulips, gardeners would liberally sprinkle paint powders of the desired hue on the theory that rainwater would wash the color down to the roots, where it would be taken up by the bulbs. Charlatans sold recipes believed to produce magic color breaks. Pigeon droppings were thought to be an effective agent, as was plaster dust taken from walls of old houses. Unlike the alchemists, whose attempts to change base metals into gold reliably failed, now and then would-be tulip changers would be rewarded with a good break, inspiring everybody to redouble their efforts. What the Dutch could not have known was that a virus was responsible for the magic of the broken tulip, a fact that as soon as it was discovered, doomed the beauty it had made possible. The color of a tulip actually consists of two pigments working in concert, a base color that is always yellow or white, and a second, laid-on color that is a mix of two hues, determines the unitary color we see. This virus works partially and irregularly, suppressing the anthocyanin, thereby allowing a portion of underlying color to show through. It wasn't until the 1920s, after the invention of the electron microscope, that scientists discovered the virus was being spread from tulip to tulip by the peach potato aphid. I thought that I would give you just an idea of how things were when the bottom dropped out of the tremendous tulip success in Holland. This is from a book called Tulipomania by Mike Dash. The collapse of the tulip trade after February 3rd was so complete that virtually no information survived concerning the sort of prices paid for bulbs in the spring of 1637. It would appear the only buyers left in the market were the connoisseurs and perhaps a few rich florists who were not entirely dependent on flowers for their wealth, and that only the rarest and most superbly fine varieties had a chance at all of being sold. According to one contemporary, a tulip that had been worth 5,000 guilders before the crash was sold for 50 guilders. In May, a bed of tulips that may have fetched 600 to 1,000 guilders in January is said to have changed hands for 6 guilders. So this was a terrible crash. Of course, if you were to go to Amsterdam in the spring now, you would see that the tulip is back and thriving. But at that time, it was a phenomenal rise to fame and then a phenomenal fall. There's so much that you could learn about the tulip, and I suggest that you do some research of your own and that you enjoy tulips wherever they might be this spring. I'm told that Red Butte Gardens outside of Salt Lake is ablaze with daffodils and tulips, also Thanksgiving Point. And if you have an opportunity, do as I plan to do and visit one of those two places or both of them. So this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.